Warning. The podcast which you are about to hear contains major plot spoilers for the entire Halloween franchise. Halloween 1978. It's not only regarded as one of the greatest horror movies of all time, but one of the scariest. Not only did it give birth to an iconic score that plays every Halloween season, but its most memorable part is the man behind the mask, the shape, the boogeyman himself, Michael Myers. But have you ever thought who really is Michael Myers? Have you ever wondered why he never really talks? Or why he only walks towards his victims instead of running? Or have you ever wondered, is there more to the man in the white, pale, faceless mask that we don't know about? On this episode of Horror for Dummies, we look deep into the mind of one of cinematic's most famous slasher icons, Michael Myers. Michael Myers, the man, the myth, the enigma. Since he slowly lumbered onto the screen and into horror fans' hearts in John Carpenter's 1978 classic, Michael has become synonymous with horror movies and the stuff of nightmares. While Michael was on the pop culture scene before his counterparts, Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger, both of whom arguably exist due to Michael's influences, Michael has had a harder time fitting into the larger pop culture context. Easily recognisable to horror fans, many mainstream audience members didn't click with Michael the way they had with the wisecracking Freddy or Jason's oddly sympathetic rage. Michael never fit into a mould which would grant him mainstream recognition. It didn't help that while the Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th franchises grew into wacky parodies of themselves, the Halloween franchise maintained its stoic and dark roots. Michael Myers is a blank canvas of evil. Producers, directors, and writers all added to this mythology. Some worked, while others fell flat and ultimately left more questions open than answered. But each Halloween sequel has its supporters. So the purpose of this piece is we're going to look into each individual film, and with the help of fan theories and university studies, we're going to see what we truly know about the man behind the mask.
You ever done anything like this before?
Only minimum security.
I see. The driveway is a few hundred yards up on the right.
The only thing that ever bothers me is their gibberish. When they start raving on and on.
You haven't anything to worry about. He hasn't spoken a word in 15 years.
the biggest question regarding the Halloween franchise and Michael Myers himself is he human or supernatural? And the only real person who could give us a definite answer is the creator, John Carpenter.
You can't kill the boogeyman.
I wanted the audience not to know whether he was human or supernatural. And he had no character. He was blank. He was simply evil. He's like the wind. He's out there. He's going to get you.
And that's what's the most terrifying.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. It's what you don't know about, what you can't see. It's out there.
This is a question where everyone has an opinion, but to really break it down, we must look at each individual film as a standalone film. For me personally, I'm starting with the 1978 classic Halloween. This is where we start. Let's start with the original, the classic, and in my opinion, the best one of the lot. This Michael Myers is not supernatural. He's not immortal or impervious. He is a mentally disturbed patient with formidable strength and a high tolerance to pain. He is a rage-fueled adrenaline nightmare of a human being. But let's look into the wounds and the damage that Michael suffered through the first film. So he was stabbed in the neck, he was stabbed in the eye, he was shot 6 times, and he falls off a balcony. No mortal man could survive that, except 50 Cent. If you are lucky and avoid or any critical damage, you could walk away with this, but would still require medical attention. The pain from the injuries would be enough to level most people, but of course Michael is not most people. Again, this is just my thoughts on the first film, but making him mortal just ruins the film for me, ruins the franchise to me, and the mythos of Michael Myers. We'll come back to this film because there is a little bit more that I want to focus on about Michael's mythos with the first film. But let's get into the sequels, and this is where it gets difficult. What was responsible for his resurrection and immortality in the first is impossible to know, but the damage he sustains in the sequels is much more serious than the first film and survivable by no one. So let's look at Halloween 2 from 1981.
Stop! He's dead. No, he's not. Look at him. He's still breathing.
Now, we remember Michael being shot in both eyes, then blown up. And the last we see of Michael is his face burning with fire pouring out of his eye sockets. Now, no mortal man will be able to survive that. But let's try to give some explanation to at least the gunshot to the eyes. I can't really talk too much about the fire burning up, Michael. That's just a little too far-fetched for my taste. But let's try and shed some light on the gunshots. So, how was he able to see from part 4 onwards? That's the big question here. Well, what if Laurie didn't shoot Michael right in the eyeballs? I mean, it's possible. She's a normal, everyday teenage girl. She probably wouldn't have much experience with guns, and those 2 shots, we could just class them as lucky shots. But let's look deeper into it. Now, if you watch the film and you pause it at the right moment, you can see Michael's eyes are still clearly intact. Now, what if she shot him twice close to the eyes, perhaps right above them? Perhaps the bullets grazed the eyebrows and the blood that gushed out from those wounds was obstructing Michael's vision. What if that was the way it went? Sure, it's a stretch, but it's the only way I can really sleep at night. But there are 2 other passing notes that I need to make point of in this film, and that's the attempt at explaining Michael's immortality and motive. Now, in Halloween 2, Dr. Loomis eventually connects Michael to the occult and Samhain, which is led to believe how Michael can withstand pain and death itself. So what is Samhain? Well, Samhain is a Gaelic end of harvest festival which ushers in the beginning of the darker half of the year. The description in the film is very brief. All we see is the writing in blood on a chalkboard, and we aren't given much to work off. We'll come back to that in part 6. The other thing I must make note of is the brother and sister relationship that they loosely say. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to pause right there. I feel that this connection is very weakly given in the movie. You don't know much. I don't even remember if Laurie finds out that Michael is her brother. All I remember is Laurie having flashbacks at her childhood, which can represent that the brother and sister relationship is going ahead. But this is something that I was never for. I was never in for Michael being the older brother of Laurie. For one, it doesn't really make sense. For two, it makes him less scary. I mean, think about it. I'm no longer scared of Michael because, well, he's not my brother, so why should I fear him? This, to me, is just something that was loosely put together to get an explanation out there, and in my opinion, I'm kind of glad that the new movie is taking that away. But let's jump into part 4 now. Of course, we are missing part 3 because it doesn't have Michael Myers in it, and I will not stand here and let anyone speak ill of that cinematic masterpiece of a movie. So Halloween 4. Now, the opening of Halloween 4 explains that Michael survived fire shooting out of his mask in Halloween 2 through sustained burns and has been in a coma since. That's 10 years. Michael has been in a coma for 10 years. Okay. Now, in part 4, he's after his niece, Jamie, who somehow manages to take Michael's evil in some sort of transfer and thus almost becomes the new embodiment of evil. This film goes more into the supernatural realm of Michael. It states, as he was previously comatose with full body burns for 10 years and instantly started to wake up when he discovered he has living family members. This proves that Michael is out to get his family and his family alone. This proves that there is a supernatural point to Michael. Now, of course, Halloween 4 is the start of a new timeline in the Halloween franchise, one that's going to continue from part 4 all the way to part 6. Now, let's go into the next film, which is Halloween part 5, which is much the same as part 4. We're given the same characters and pretty much the same story to a little bit. There's nothing really happens with the character of Michael except we see a more human side to him as he sheds a tear with holding Jamie's hand. This also introduces the Man in Black, which will come in full circle in part 6. So let's go with part 6 right now. Now, this one is tricky because there have been so many cuts of this film and all of them are different in some way. I mean, we have the theatrical cut, the producer's cut, the unrated cut, whatever you have it. But Halloween 6 follows Tommy Doyle, who is all grown up and is still obsessed with Michael Myers, as is the entire town of Haddonfield. Jamie is also all grown up and is being held by the mysterious Thorn cult. Michael kills Jamie after she gives birth. Now, in the producer's cut, it is revealed that Michael is the baby's father. So, Michael had relations with his niece, is what we're going at. Okay, so the film spreads through an attempt to resolve many of the questions asked in the previous film, but in my opinion, it only serves to leave more loose ends in its wake. Ultimately, the final takeaway from Halloween 6 is that Michael Myers is sort of controlled by a cult who has been a part of Michael's life since he was institutionalized. There are multiple uses of a sinister tattoo and star configurations that appear around Halloween, causing the curse of the thorn, which Tommy speculates causes Michael's murderous rages to wipe out his entire family. Tommy theorizes that the curse of the thorn is what makes Michael invincible, and that his son, / great nephew, is Michael's last sacrifice, which makes about as much sense as anything else in this movie. Now, what is the Thorn Cult? Well, okay, let's try to explain this. It can get confusing, I'm not going to lie. So what is the Thorn Cult? Well, among the ancient druids, Thorn represented a demon that spread sickness that brought death to hundreds of thousands of people. Now, according to a Celtic legend, one child from each tribe was chosen to be inflicted with the curse of Thorn. In this circumstances, of course, we have Michael Myers. Now, to have the blood sacrifices of its next of kin on the night of Samhain, which is Halloween. The sacrifice of one family meant sparing the lives of an entire tribe. That explains why Michael killed his sister.
But the thorn symbol is actually a constellation of stars that appears from time to time on Halloween night. Whenever it appears, he appears. I must also make note that I have the tattoo of the thorn cult on my wrist because of this movie. That's not saying that I enjoy this movie. I think it's fine. I think it has redeemable qualities, but it's not one of the Halloween films that I would pick up straight away. So let's jump back into the original timeline now. We're skipping the Jamie Lloyd timeline, as I'll call it. Now we're going back to the original timeline with Halloween H2O. Now, in the mythology of Michael Myers from Halloween H2O, it only really serves to illustrate that Michael is very good at taking off his clothes and putting them on someone else. We don't really see much more from Michael in this movie. So let's jump into Halloween Resurrection now. And I'm not going to lie, there's not much to say about this movie. To me, Halloween Resurrection is another cash grab, and it just proves that Michael Myers hates reality TV show. That's all I'm going to say about it, because there's really not much to say. That movie is poop. But this is where the conversation can get a little contrived. Rob Zombie's remake. If you want to call it a remake, reimagining, I don't know. There's too many different names for these types of movies. But let's talk about Rob Zombie's Halloween. Now, much like the first film, this one acts much the same, but is the complete opposite. And you're probably thinking, yes, well, it's gorier. There's a lot more swear words. But I'm not talking about anything like that. This is something that I learned off a fellow podcaster named Mr. Watson from the Horror Corridor. Great show, and you should definitely take a listen. He put this film perfectly. Now, Mr. Watson states, this comes to the point of nature versus nurture. See, the 1978 classic, we can argue all day whether Michael is human or supernatural. But here's the thing. In the 1978 classic, it was all nature. As we saw in the opening to Halloween, Michael had a good childhood. He had good parents, a nice home, etc., etc. Now we jump onto the Rob Zombie version. This is where it's total opposite. This is complete nurture. Michael had a rough childhood, and that's one of the main reasons why so many people have problems with this film, along with the dialogue and a few other things. But to me, this is exactly why it works so well. Rob Zombie must have known that the John Carpenter classic could not have been remade, and there is no way that he could do the original justice and would have to deliver something completely different. So he turned the film on its head. Mr. Watson is a complete genius, I'm going to say that right now. For him to realize that, it's just made it so much clearer for so many people, including myself. I was always a big fan of the Rob Zombie Halloween films. I found them a lot more entertaining than the original. This is me going back to when I was a stupid teenager and didn't really understand the original film. So the Rob Zombie mindless killing version of Michael Myers was up my alley. It wasn't until I was a bit older where I started to appreciate the original Halloween. Let's jump into Halloween 2, Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, H2, as some people call it. And this is, from a lot of people's opinion, on the bottom of the list, right there with the Resurrection. This is one that I'm a fan of. I have the actual cover of this movie tattooed on my arm. I find it has flaws, of course, so do many of you guys, but there are some redeemable qualities about this film. Now let's talk about them. The first part is the hospital scene. To me, this is incredible. I love the opening to this movie. We have Michael Myers in full brutality mode. When he stabs that woman in the back of the head, I love every second of it. Yes, it sounds like a Mack truck hitting you at 1,000 miles an hour, but it's still entertaining. And I know it's a dream sequence. We can all get past that. I just love it. I think it's great. It's a shout out to the original Halloween 2, and I just love it. The other redeemable point about this movie is Annie's death. Now, if we go back to the original Halloween 2, this one to me is, it's written pretty poorly. Sheriff Brackett putting his hand over his mouth after he sees his dead daughter. I mean, I'm sorry, I can't take you serious there. I mean, I have kids. If I see them dead after a murder got to them, I'm not just going to put my hand over my mouth and then get angry at the doctor. I'm going to be in absolute hysterics, just like Sheriff Brackett did in this movie. Brad Dourif does an amazing job at this, and it really, really kicks your heartstrings in this scene when we have the flashbacks of Annie as a young child and Sheriff Brackett crying in the background. Loved how Rob Zombie did that. So that concludes the actual film portion of this podcast, but that really hasn't answered any questions, has it? Is Michael Myers human or supernatural?
Why won't he die?
It's really a question that you put in your own perspective. To me, Michael Myers is complete human. That's the way I like to go off it. I only go off the first film. The rest are just, fan films, if you want to call them that. The original film is the only one for me. And this new one coming out seems to be doing everything right, in my opinion. So let's see how they will go on with that. But let's get back to the question at hand. And let's dive into Michael's disorders. Let's talk about university quotes, I'll call them. I don't think they're real university, but that's what the Google is saying. So, why doesn't Michael speak? It's a big question. I mean, we have a lot of killers that don't speak. Jason Voorhees, Leatherface. But Michael was the first, if I can remember correctly. Now, the psychiatric students taking the Red Rum psychopathology course. Yes, it's called Red Rum. I'll get to that in a second. They have come up with a reason why Michael doesn't speak. All right, I need to address it. The Red Rum psychopathology course. Red Rum stands for reviewing mental, in brackets, disease with a rudimentary understanding of the macabre. Quite catchy, I gotta admit. Now, Michael Myers losing the ability to speak after murdering his sister showcases conversion disorder, where symptoms of acute or chronic stress manifest physically. Myers also suffers from voyeurism and autism. Let's go back to the first part there. Michael Myers losing the ability to speak after murdering his sister showcases conversion disorder. This is something that I can get on board with. This is shown in a more medical study of how Michael Myers is human. Now let's talk about conversion disorder for a second. What is conversion disorder? Well, according to Google, conversion disorder is a mental condition in which a person has blindness, paralysis, or other nervous system symptoms that cannot be explained by medical evaluation. So there we have it. There's something that is believable as to why Michael doesn't speak. But let's go into voyeurism now. What is voyeurism? Well, a person who derives sexual gratification from observing the naked bodies or sexual acts of others, especially from a secret vantage point. So maybe that's the reason why Michael was after girls. Maybe he didn't want to hurt them. Maybe he just wanted a woman's touch. Did we ever think of that? It's stupid, I know, but we can go into it. But let's go into more disorders. Now, according to the wiki page, which has 748 pages dedicated to this franchise, Michael has a disorder called catatonia. Now, Michael is sometimes disabled from moving whether he either sits or stands. Now, this makes sense because it explains why Michael walks after his victims rather than runs. He exhibits stupor, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, also which is an inherited disorder. But here's where it gets kind of creepy in my opinion. Dr. Loomis asserts that Michael was faking his catatonia to draw them away from his plans of escape and murdering his family. Now this is quite likely, and if this is true, this proves that Michael is more psychotic than catatonic. And this is what kind of gets under my skin a little bit, gets on my nerves, the fact that Michael is completely with it and knows every step that he's making, which kind of scares me a bit. We all know that Michael is a smart killer, but the fact that he knows everything that he's doing and can plan ahead creeps me out just a little bit. But let's continue. Now, in Michael Myers' case, he experiences an extreme loss of motor skills, or he can even experience hyperactivity. In this case, it's murdering people that he sees. When he was in Smith's Grove Sanitarium, he expressed rigid poses for hours and ignore any external stimuli. Michael also seems to be psychotic, engaging in sadism and mass murder. However, he may also be sociopathic, which means a total lack of emotion. It may be proven that Michael Myers may have schizophrenia because the reason most people that have schizophrenia experience catatonia also. Now, the novelization of this film goes more into detail into Michael's schizophrenia, explaining that he saw visions of a disabled Celtic child named Edna, who murdered his crush after she refused to acknowledge him. He also claims that he heard voices that told him to hate people. And there you have it, people. This is disorders that go into the reason why I believe Michael is human. Now, we'll go more into why I think Michael is human when I go into fan theories, but we kind of touched on the novelization just a little bit there. So I kind of want to talk more about the novelization of the original Halloween film, because it kind of ties in with loose ends and gives you a bit of a more understanding of Michael Myers.
Leave me alone!
He's gonna get you!
The boogeyman is coming!
Leave me alone!
He doesn't believe us. Don't you know what happens on Halloween?
Yeah, we get candy.
The boogeyman!
So the Halloween novelization comes from 1979 by Curtis Richards from the 1978 horror film Halloween, of course, which fortunately has been out of print since the late 1980s, so good luck getting that. The novel elaborates on aspects not featured in the film, such as the origins of the curse of Samhain and the Michael Myers life in Smith's Grove Sanitarium. For example, the opening reads, "The horror started on the eve of Samhain, in a foggy vale in Northern Ireland, at the dawn of the Celtic race. And once started, it trod the earth forevermore, wreaking its savagery suddenly, swiftly, and with incredible ferocity." The prologue of the novel takes place at the dawn of the Celtic race in Ireland, and tells the story of a young 15-year-old disfigured boy named Edna, who is passionately in love with the King Gwyn's daughter, Deirdre. I apologize if I'm messing these names up. They're not really names that you see on a day-to-day basis, so I apologize. After being severely humiliated for attempting to win her love, Edna attacks and brutally slays Deirdre and her fiancé at a community ritual event on Halloween. Edna is immediately killed by the other members of the village and his soul cursed to wander the earth forever, recreating the events of this film. How would you feel if this was the start, the opening to the film Halloween? For me, if you're asking me, I would hate it. Because this shows that Michael Myers is not just a mental patient that escaped a hospital. No, this shows that there is more a supernatural side to him, and I can't get on board with that. I'm sorry. I love the mental patient break out of the hospital, I'm coming to get you story. But let's continue with chapter 1. We go to 1963 and witness several eerie interactions between little Michael Myers and his grandmother. The grandmother is concerned, as Michael has been admitting to hearing voices and having visions. The voices tell me to say I hate people, says Michael, according to what his mother tells his grandmother. There is also a discussion between the grandmother and Michael's mother about Michael's great-grandfather, who apparently committed some sort of undescribed violent act. I think there are enough similarities, says the concerned grandmother. Chapter 10 then goes on to reveal that he shot a couple of people to death at a harvest dance on Halloween in 1899 and was later hanged for the murders. Now, Chapter 2 details Michael's experiences further. While he, along with some other children, are dressed in the infamous clown disguise, complete with the mask, which we see from the first film, Michael later knocks on the Myers home door for trick-or-treating. His sister Judy asks, "What are you going to do if I don't give you anything?" To which Michael replies, "We're going to kill you." That's pretty scary for a six-year-old to say. Shocked, Judy responds, "Who said that? Michael Myers, was that you?" Michael replies, "I'm not Michael Myers, I'm a clown." Already hinting at the transformation that has taken place. Now this is where it gets interesting, because we're going into chapter 3 now. We take a look inside Michael's head. It was the voice. The voice stirred up the hatred. It had done so in his dreams, and now it was doing it in real life. It had begun with this strange picture in his head at night. Pictures of people he had seen. Oh, well, maybe in comic books or on television, but never in real life. People in strange costumes, animal skins, armor, leather, drinking and dancing wildly around a fire. One couple in particular. They looked like Judy and Danny, madly in love with each other, dancing in a circle around a huge bonfire, while he, Michael, stood in the crowd hating them, burning up with jealousy. We'll then go into chapter 4, which details Michael's trial and sentencing. And this is something that I kind of wish was in the film. I would have liked seeing Michael as a boy in Smith's Grove Sanitarium. Yes, we get that in Rob Zombie's film, but I would have liked to see the original Michael going through the trial and everything like that. Anyway, continue with chapter 4. Most interestingly, the details of Michael's experience at Smith's Grove Sanitarium are given. A conversation between Michael and Loomis gives further insight into Michael's personality. Additionally, strange occurrences take place which intrigue Dr. Loomis, who gradually became aware of what he was dealing with. Every time Michael was slighted by a staff member or another inmate, some awful vengeance was visited upon the offending person. It might be a week, a day, or a month later, but Michael got even. The problem for Loomis was that no one ever observed the boy doing it directly. For example, a nurse who quarreled with Michael fell down the stairs 2 days later, fracturing her pelvis. A boy who borrowed a game from Michael and forgot to return it suffered a vicious rash that hospitalized him for a month. Michael eventually commands the ward, as neither the staff nor the other inmates dared to challenge or defy Michael for fear of retribution. Over the next few years, more novels were published, including novels for part 2, 3, and 4. But we're not going to go into those today. Instead, I want to take you on to something that I find interesting, which is fan theories of Halloween.
Michael Myers has come back to Haddonfield to kill.
Now, of course, these are fan theories, so they're not to be taken seriously, and some of them will actually blow your mind and make you double think about Halloween. Some of them are just completely crazy and laughable. So let's go into fan theories of Halloween. The first one is, Dr. Loomis is actually the same Loomis from the movie Psycho. You have my interest, I'll admit that, so let's go into it. In this theory, the name Sam Loomis is more than just a homage to the iconic horror film and a subtle reference to Jamie Lee Curtis's pedigree. Think about it. What would Sam Loomis do after failing to save his girlfriend in Psycho? Maybe he decides to combat psychosis by going back to school to become a psychiatrist. He then decides to start fresh in Illinois, where he is assigned to treat a young boy who murdered his sister. That makes sense, but let's continue. The only real reason to doubt it is that John Carpenter hasn't yet confirmed it as truth. It explains why Loomis isn't like a normal psychiatrist. He feels a personal duty to try and stop Michael as if it was a second chance for him. When Michael escapes and starts murdering, it would only make sense that Loomis would go on a crusade to stop him with the same obsession as Ahab had seeking his white whale. This is an interesting one. One that I can get on board with, quite honestly. And if you... The website I'm looking at right now has the pictures of Loomis from Psycho and Loomis from Halloween, and I can actually see there being a real possibility on that. It's fun to think about, and hey, what if John Carpenter came out and said that was actually the way he wrote it? The second one is, Michael Myers has a congenital insensitivity to pain. Okay? A real condition, CIP, is basically the inability to feel pain. Taking stab wounds, bullets, and third-degree burns in stride, Michael doesn't seem to let pain hold him back. The absence of any pain indicator would also explain his complete lack of empathy for victims. He also uses this condition to his advantage in his workout routine. Putting in extra reps to get a strength of 10 gorillas. Okay, that's going a bit far. But this is another one that can be kind of believable, to be honest. I mean, with this condition, now I'm not a doctor in any sense of the word, but with this condition, maybe that's why Michael was so strong. Maybe he doesn't feel his muscles ripping from his arm when he's holding a victim up above his head. Just something to think about, who knows. So that's number two. Number three, this one is... I was going to say this one is complete silliness, but it actually makes complete sense now I think about it. Michael Myers' childhood mask was made by Silver Shamrock. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is a masterpiece in my opinion. I'll have no one saying ill about that movie. We follow the Silver Shamrock Company, which uses killer masks as a ploy for a guy to usher in a new age of witchcraft. It has nothing to do with Michael Myers, or does it? According to this theory, the clown mask that Michael wears at the beginning of the original Halloween is a beta test of the mask that we see in Halloween 3. The mask grants him immortality, this is why he can't be killed, but it has the unintended side effect of making him go crazy and kills his family, and just about any other person he sees in his past. Silver Shamrock decides they need to work out some of the kinks and hides the evidence. Oh man, imagine if they, now I'm kind of upset, because imagine if they revealed this in Halloween 3. It would make, I actually like to go off this rather than the timeline of 4 to 6. I think this is a creative, ingenious idea. I love it. Number 4 is Michael Myers is autistic. Okay, let's go in. Some have suggested that Michael is autistic. He doesn't speak, exhibits repetitive, realistic behavior, is obsessive, and has problems with his motor skills. His obsession with the day Halloween could be attributed to a diagnostic of autism, as well as his compulsion to kill people in the same ways over and over. Michael seems to lack the ability to comprehend theory of mind, which is traditionally a defining characteristic of autism. His complete lack of empathy would seem to be the result of an extreme deficiency in that area. As Dr. Loomis says, I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I apologize for not trying to attempt to say that in Dr. Loomis's voice, but I'm not very good with voices, so yeah. Number 5, look, that fan theory is another one that I brought up before, like another medical reason as to why Michael Myers is, and one that I just proves my point that Michael Myers is human. Okay, so this next one is really interesting. Dr. Loomis is the real villain. Alright. A blog writer asks the question, is Dr. Loomis's franchise real boogeyman? This writer begins to be reminded by readers that John Carpenter has intended the first Halloween movie to be a standalone film. The only information we had about these characters, and the only information the creator ever intended us to have about them, came from one movie. Disregarding the later backstory additions, this writer makes the case that the first time we see little Michael after stabbing his sister, his expression is one of shock and fear, not evil glee. It seems like he is appalled by his own actions. Then we know nothing about his 15 interviewing years in the institution, except when Dr. Loomis tells us. Loomis describes the child is evil incarnate. But is it possible? Just possible, mind you, that Dr. Sam Loomis is either flat out lying or greatly oversimplifying the facts. The writer equates Loomis to other characters like Dr. Ahab and Dr. Frankenstein, suggesting that Loomis's obsession with Michael either initially or unintentionally turned him into a disturbed little boy who could be saved into a monster. The writer then goes to write, "In my interpretation of Halloween, Dr. Loomis viewed the six-year-old Michael Myers as the personification of evil, because that's what he wanted to see in the boy. Thus, Loomis's idea of Michael becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, treat him like a killer and he becomes a killer. For 15 years, Michael was Loomis's own little science experiment, his own Frankenstein's monster. I can imagine Loomis telling Michael over and over again that he is evil and the devil himself, and constantly, constantly reminding him of the events of Haddonfield in 1963. The writer even suggests Loomis may have intentionally let Michael loose on Haddonfield and guided him on his murderous spree. But this one is a little far-fetched. I think this writer, is looking too deep into it. This next one is something that creeps me out. Don't ask why, it just gets under my skin a bit. This one is entitled, Michael Can Talk. In this theory, Michael can and does talk. He blends in, acting as several background characters throughout the series. Specifically in Halloween 4, he points out Ted Hollister in the bushes and gets the poor kid shot up. Okay, this one gets under my skin. Why, you ask? I don't know. The fact that it goes back to Michael, Dr. Loomis believing that Michael is not catatonic and just using that as a way to get out. This one gets under my skin because it goes back to the fact that Michael is completely psychotic and knows exactly what he's doing. He has a plan, and he's one step forward than everyone else, and that kind of creeps me out, I've got to admit. And the fact that Michael Myers could just take off his mask and talk like nothing happened is unnerving to me, to say the least. Alright, the next one is Michael Myers is triggered by sex. Yes, we touched on this before, but let's go into it. Walking in on your sister having sex would mess up any six-year-old. Having to deal with it on a nearly constant basis while you wander around unsupervised is a recipe for disaster. At least that is what the fan theory suggests, and is much of a basis for Rob Zombie's Halloween remake. It certainly seems plausible enough on the surface. One night, Michael gets fed up and snaps, murdering his naked half-sister. He escapes his confinement at the mental institution on Halloween night and just tries to mind his own business at the abandoned house, only to find more teenagers basically having sex. The only problem with this theory is that John Carpenter and Deborah Hill themselves have refuted it. They say that the sex theme was just a matter of practicality. The teens were too abstracted by sex to effectively notice the killer stalking them, while Laurie Strode was better equipped to deal with the murderer because she wasn't so preoccupied. Well, it's already been debunked by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, but an interesting one nonetheless. This next one is, well, it's interesting. I haven't seen this TV show, but the title is Michael Makes an Appearance in American Horror Story. Once again, I haven't seen American Horror Story. I've tried a few times, but I just don't have the time to get onto it. Now, fans of American Horror Story will remember little Michael Harmon, constant smile, toe-headed little grandson who might also be the Antichrist. A murderous, maybe supernatural little psychopath named Michael? Naturally, some have suggested that Constance may have bundled up her little angel after he gleefully murdered his nanny and moved them both to Illinois. Of course, that leaves a lot unexplained. Where did his sister come from, for starters? But it's fun to think. This one is the last one that I'm going to tell you right now, and this one is the most craziest one out there, but the most fun. And quite honestly, I would jump with joy if this was actually what happened, because I believe this is a lot of fun. Michael Myers is Chucky. That's right, Chucky from Child's Play. All right, what if young Michael Myers was simply possessed by the spirit of Charles Lee Ray, making the Child's Play series a set of prequels to Halloween? Perhaps earlier that fateful Halloween night, Charles Lee Ray finally succeeded in using voodoo to transfer his soul into the unwitting carrier of little Michael. Yes, okay, it's absurd and crazy, but think about it. It kind of makes sense in a way, and it's fun to think about. That's it for fan theories. A lot of them make sense. I'm going to tell you the truth. A lot of them make sense. Some of them are downright crazy and just fun to think about, much like the Chucky is Michael Myers scenario. Okay, so that's basically it for Who is Michael Myers and my deep dive into Michael Myers. I hope you enjoyed that little theory. But to end this episode, I want to talk about the new upcoming Halloween film, which I believe is just called Halloween. It hasn't been given a tagline or anything like that, so I'm just going to call it Halloween 18 so you don't get confused.
Testing 1, 2, 3. We're on.
We're here to investigate a patient that killed 3 innocent teenagers on a Halloween in 1978. He was shot by his own psychiatrist and taken into custody that night. And has spent the last 40 years in captivity. Hello, Michael. I have something you might like to see.
So let's start with what we already know about this soon-to-be film. Well, we know it's directed by David Gordon Green, who also directed Pineapple Express. It's also written by Danny McBride, who was the star of Eastbound and Down, amongst other comical films and TV shows. Now, the funny thing about these two guys is they're in the comedy genre a lot of the time, most of the time, actually. So it's kind of curious to see that, well, if you ask me, when I heard about this news, I wasn't too keen for it. But then we got A Quiet Place and Get Out, both whom are directed by comedic guys, and they were both stellar. Excellent films. So this one, from the reviews I've been hearing, it's been good. So let's keep it going. Hopefully I won't be disappointed. But returning to the movie is John Carpenter, who's doing the score, which we've heard of now, and it sounds incredible. Love it. But along with that is Jamie Lee Curtis coming back to reprise her role as Laurie. The other returning actor in this movie is Nick Castle, who's returning to play Michael Myers. Now, weeks ago, I thought Nick Castle was playing Michael Myers throughout this whole film, but apparently he'll only be in a couple of scenes. Actor James Jude Courtney will be playing the role for the majority of filming. Who is James Jude Courtney? Well, he's a veteran actor and stuntman and had been playing Michael the whole film. When David Gordon Green invited Castle to the set to play the character for a couple of scenes, there was an interview with Jude Courtney, and he quotes, "David was also really sensitive and generous when he said, 'We're inviting Nick Castle to come back to do a little work. Do you have a problem with that because you're the Michael Myers now?' Which is really quite respectful." He continues, and I was like, "Oh my God, are you kidding me? What an honor it would be. First of all, to meet the guy, but secondly, to work with him. How good does that get?" So we started to work, and I can't remember if it was the second or third week that Nick came in and did a kind of cameo. He did a couple of scenes, and I'm in the scenes with him, which is really beautiful. He and I were hoping this would happen, because he even said, "This is a passing of the torch." We met with foreign journalists on set, and Nick was so super gracious and just saying, "Look, I've come in to do a cameo. Jim is our Michael Myers now." So that's another point of respect right there. Courtney later clarified the scenes would be intercut, between shots of the two playing Michael, and that reports Courtney would only be acting as a stunt double on the film were incorrect. Now this leads to the question, what scenes will Nick Castle be playing? Now if we remember, the original story is 40 years old, which makes Michael Myers in this film 61 years old. Now, in the trailer, it shows the documentaries talking to Michael, who is chained up and of course doesn't have his mask on at that point. So I'm curious to know, will that be Nick Castle? Will he be the one playing Michael Myers at that point? I'm also curious to know, will we see a close-up shot of Michael Myers' face without the mask? Now of course we all know that this upcoming film ignores all other sequels, including Part 2, which brought to light the brother and sister relationship. which I'm on board with. Now, let's talk about questions that I have about this film. I'm curious to find out how Laurie and Michael will tie in together, now that they've taken away the brother and sister part. Are they going to explain why Michael is coming back for Laurie? Maybe. Maybe they're lying and Laurie will be Myers' sister in the end. We don't know about that. Or maybe Laurie is the one hunting down Myers. Hell, maybe this film is about time travel and Laurie goes back in time to take Myers out once and for all, like in Terminator. I hope that's not the story. That would be horrible. Another question I want to know is, will Michael die in the end? I mean, how are you going to end it? Are you going to do the same thing you did in the first film, which is have him disappeared? Michael dying at the end is a possibility, but the new reports coming out now that Blumhouse have come out and said that they will do sequels depending how big this entry gets, which it pretty much confirms that there will be sequels because this is already started to make money. But if there are sequels, how can Michael die? Does Laurie die instead? Another question I had will this one pick up straight after the first one ended? Like in part two. But what happens from there? Are we going to see what happens after Michael disappears? Are we going to see him picked up by the cops and locked up? Or are we just going to flash forward to 40 years ahead and he's just in prison? Another question I have is, what's the go with Dr. Loomis? Now, obviously he won't be in the film. He was in his late, I'm going to guess, in his late 50s, early 60s. So this is now 40 years later. So he's obviously not going to be in the film. But will we see family members, his son perhaps, or anything like that? I am curious to know if they'll even bring him up. I hope they do. I really do. So this now brings me to the last portion of this podcast. And this is where I want to put my two cents in on the new Halloween film. My predictions as it stands. What do I think will happen? Before I do this, I must say that I'm just a fan of this series. Nothing more, nothing else. Just a fan who has opinions on this movie. Whether you believe my opinions or not is up to you. So here's what I believe will happen. I believe that this film will open up with the ending of the first film. We'll end with the gunshots and Michael falling off the balcony with Laurie asking Dr. Loomis, is that the boogeyman? As a matter of fact, it was blah, 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 all that stuff. We'll then open up with a new film. And this can either go two ways. One, we open up with Michael, of course, if he disappeared, but we can open up with Michael completely vanishing for 40 years. 40 years. We won't see him for the next 40 years, and then the story will tie into present day. I don't think they'll go that route, and quite honestly, I don't want them to go that route. I believe that we see Michael walking around Haddonfield just like part 2 did, and then eventually get captured. This will eventually lead him going back to Smith's Grove Sanitarium, and then the movie will proceed from there. I believe that Michael will be captured by maybe a SWAT team or something like that. Something will happen, and we'll see Michael be restrained and taken to Smith's Grove Sanitarium. Dr. Loomis. Will they bring up Dr. Loomis? One, I said before, I don't think Dr. Loomis will be in this movie. I think it would be stupid if they brought back Dr. Loomis, because of course he'd be 100, maybe more, and that's just ridiculous. But do I think that they bring up Dr. Loomis, or maybe have a family member of Dr. Loomis, Dr. Loomis's son, or something like that? I feel that they will bring up Dr. Loomis, but we won't see any family member of his. I feel like maybe Laurie is going to be the new Dr. Loomis, in a way. She's going to get to that role. Of course, Michael will be after Laurie's granddaughter, and she's the one with the most experience. Laurie's the one with the most experience, so I think Smith's Grove Sanitarium might be looking to Laurie for answers in this subject. The last thing I feel is that, of course, we have Laurie's granddaughter in this film, and I feel like she's going to be the final girl in this movie. Now, this cuts straight to the ending. What do I think will happen at the end? Of course, we're going to get the showdown between Michael and Laurie. What do I think is going to happen, though? Do I think Michael's going to die? Do I think Laurie's going to die? Do I think they'll both survive and continue? I believe I believe that this will be the end of Laurie Strode's. I believe Laurie will die at this, but I feel like it will kind of be a she sacrificed herself for her granddaughter or her daughter or something like that. Maybe then bring in Laurie's granddaughter into the role of Laurie. Kind of like a passing of the torch type of thing. I feel like this will be the end of Laurie's chapter. Michael will be, I don't know, sedated or be captured again, but I don't think that Michael will die. I don't think this is the last we see of Michael, because the makers of this movie have come out and said that they planned on doing more sequels, and unless they go in the Halloween 3 route, which wouldn't be the worst thing in my opinion, I don't think this is the last we see of Michael Myers. But I feel that this is the last we see of Laurie, and to be quite honest, I'm okay with that. I think we've seen enough of Laurie, and every great story needs to have an ending. So they're just my predictions on what I think will happen in this new movie. Will I be right? Will I be wrong? It's yet to be seen. We'll find out in a week or two, depending where you're from. But this concludes this episode of Michael Myers, the Boogeyman himself. I want to thank you for sticking around and enjoying. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did enjoy this episode, please let me know. Please hit me up at horrorfordummies@hotmail.com, or you can even just get it at the Horror for Dummies Facebook page. Hit like and comment there. We're quite responsive on that, so if you can do that, that'd be great. And it would be even better if you could give us a 5-star rating. The Padded Room Network. If you could give us a 5-star rating and write something on the comments, because that's the main thing that matters, apparently. Apparently, you can't just give 5 stars. You have to write a comment. So if you just want to leave with just saying that I'm better looking than Darian, hey, that would be great. We'd really appreciate that. But this has been the end of our Michael Myers walkthrough, the Behind the Boogeyman bonus episode. If you want us to do more episodes like this, hit me up. I'm keen to actually explore more Boogeyman. Maybe Leatherface, Freddy Krueger, the Wolfman. There's plenty that are going through my head right now. But I'll leave with this, a last word, if I may. Michael Myers has been viewed as many things. He lacks the kicky backstory of a Freddy or a Jason, but can instill as much, if not more, fear in an audience. We know that he enjoys the taste of dog, and he will stop at nothing to get the girl he wants. But what we do not know, and what we will never know, is what drives Michael, and that is the scariest unknown of all. Till next time, thank you.